Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening this morning. In the first part of the program today, we'll be talking about human rights around the world. I think that a lot of people would make the argument that it's important for us to be concerned about human rights and fight for human rights on moral grounds, perhaps also on legal grounds. But often, when the subject comes up, people raise the question, is it in our national interest here in the United States to be concerned about human rights? This morning, our guest, I think, would say, yes, indeed, that is the answer to that question. It is indeed in our national interest. Our guest is William Schultz. He is executive director of Amnesty International USA and was appointed to that position in March of 1994. He is an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister. He came to Amnesty after serving for 15 years with the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, the last eight as president of that association. And he's authored a book that explores this very question, what exactly, what sort of interest we have here in this country in human rights. The title of his book is In Our Own Best Interest, and the subtitle, How Defending Human Rights Benefits Us All. It's published by the Beacon Press. And as we talk this morning with Dr. Schultz, your questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-WILL or 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. And then anywhere else that you might be listening, around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel, if you're interested in joining the conversation, you may do that and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. All we ask callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible. But anyone is welcome to be a part of the conversation. Dr. Schultz, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate it. Just initially, I think I'd like to get your reaction to a recent news development, and it certainly bears on this subject, that this was just a couple of weeks ago, at the beginning of May, the United States was voted off the UN Human Rights Commission.
That's right.
And that's the first time that has happened since this panel was set up under American leadership in 1947. And the response of some people in Congress was to withhold support from the United Nations because they felt snubbed. And I wonder what your reaction was both to the action, that is the United States being voted off the panel, and then the response from some people in the U.S. government.
There are two reasons that the United States was voted off the Human Rights Commission. The first is that the United States has been critical of a good many countries around the world for their human rights records, and quite justifiably critical through our annual State Department human rights reports and through resolutions that we had introduced in the Human Rights Commission criticizing countries like Cuba and China. And naturally, those countries were not happy with that kind of criticism and were all too willing to join together to vote the U.S. off the commission. But the other reason is probably even more important, and that is that many countries around the world, including our European allies, resent what I call American exceptionalism, the notion that is widespread that the United States, because it is a superpower, because it is a beacon of moral righteousness, as many American leaders would put it, doesn't have to play by the same rules that apply to the rest of the world. And so, for example, the United States has resisted being a part of the creation of a new international criminal court, not because we think it's a bad idea to bring tyrants to justice, but because we don't want American military servicemen and women themselves potentially subjected to the jurisdiction of the court. That, plus our withdrawal from the Kyoto Environmental Treaty Agreement, for example, our resistance to the Landmines Treaty, has created a good deal of resentment among many of our allies. And they, too, were sending, I think, a shot across the bow here. And I suspect that the reaction of the House of Representatives, which you just mentioned, in voting to withhold the last third of our pledged dues to the United Nations, simply reinforced that sense of American arrogance, the sense that the U.S., if it doesn't win a vote in the U.N., is going to take up its marbles, in this case its significant financial marbles, and go home. And I think that's an unfortunate signal to send. And I might say that it appears as if President Bush agrees. He has disapproved of the House action, and my expectation is that either the Senate will not confirm the House action or the President will take action as he can to make sure that those final one-third dues payments are paid.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about, and this is, I know it's difficult, it's a large question, but something you can say something about the record of the United States in supporting human rights around the world. I think it's the case. Certainly, we wouldn't say that the United States has failed completely. However, some people, I think, would say that there have been lapses, or perhaps there have been instances in which that we have decided that it was in our interest to support a particular regime in spite of the fact that their human rights record was poor. And so some people would say our record in supporting human rights has been checkered at best. Can you say something, make some overall kind of statement about it?
I think that your characterization of the record as checkered or mixed is an accurate one. Certainly it's true that the United States has been forthright in many situations in supporting dissidents around the world. I think, for example, of Aung San Suu Kyi, who is the leading proponent of democracy in Burma. Burma is one of the most repressive countries. The United States has supported Aung San Suu Kyi, has encouraged U.S. companies to withdraw from investments in Burma. The United States has, as I said, been the sponsor of resolutions condemning China's human rights record, and quite justifiably so for that. But in other instances, of course, the United States has unfortunately been a partner with regimes. We go back, for example, to the Pinochet regime in Chile in the 1970s, where we certainly aligned ourselves with that regime. We're in part, I suspect, responsible for the overthrow of a democratically elected government there. And, of course, the same is true in some of our ventures in Central America as well. So there is no question but what the U.S. has a mixed record, and a mixed record, of course, here at home as well, which affects our credibility when we criticize countries overseas. When the United States, for example, allows police misconduct, when we allow for prison conditions that include, in some cases, a systemic rape of women in prison by guards or with the connivance of guards, when we are the leading exporter of torture equipment used for torture, electroshock batons, serrated thumb cuffs and serrated handcuffs and leg chains. The U.S. has some 60 to 80 companies manufacturing and exporting this material. When we continue to practice the death penalty, which is a violation of international human rights norms, when we put asylum seekers, political asylum seekers, who come here because they've been persecuted for standing up for American values in their own country, and instead of welcoming them and adjudicating their cases quickly, we throw them into county jails with the regular criminal population. So in some of these ways, unfortunately, our own domestic record has also diminished our credibility as a critic of human rights elsewhere around the world.
I'm sure that we can discuss this question in some detail, but let me ask the big question. And it's my understanding, interestingly enough, that this book had its beginnings in a radio interview that you were doing, where the host of this show said, put it to you, and I'm sure that other people have asked the same question. They've said, well, you know, yes, it's on one level, I think we have to say respect for human rights is very important, but what really is it to me here living in you know, this guy was in Knoxville.
That's right.
You know, here we could say the same thing. For us, you know, here in Urbana, Illinois, in downstate Illinois, really, what is it to us if we respect human rights in Indonesia or in Latin America or Africa or any place outside the United States?
That's right. The interviewer had a very good question, I thought. He said, I'm sure we all agree that these violations you've been talking about, torture, political killings, disappearances, these are morally repugnant, of course. But to someone living here in East Tennessee or in Central Illinois who's scratching out a living, worried about paying a mortgage or sending a kid to college. What difference do these violations make to him or to her? And I thought that was a very good question, and moreover, a question that we in the human rights movement rarely stop to answer because we are so convinced of the moral righteousness of our cause. And of course, I think it is a morally righteous cause, but that alone is not enough to build a movement with mainstream Americans. And so I set out in this book to try to answer that question systematically, dealing with the ways in which human rights violations negatively affect our national security, our military interests, for example, negatively affect our jobs and our economic investments, negatively affect our environmental and public health, negatively affect population control, and many other things. And I'm more than happy to explore whichever of those you're interested in.
Sure. Let me introduce again our guest for anyone who's tuned in the last few minutes. We're speaking with Dr. William Schultz. He is the executive director of Amnesty International USA and has authored a book that explores this topic, the subject we're talking about here. So if you'd like to read more, you can look for the book. It's titled In Our Own Best Interest, How Defending Human Rights Benefits Us All. It's published by the Beacon Press in Boston. And questions are welcome here, too. 333-WILL or 9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Perhaps before going on specifically talking about some of the dimensions of this question, why it is in our interest, perhaps you should talk a little bit about what, when we talk about human rights, what is it we're really talking about? What do we mean when we use that phrase?
Well, human rights fundamentally derive from the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was created by the UN Human Rights Commission at the behest of the United States. Eleanor Roosevelt was chair of that commission when the document was passed, and then it was passed by the United Nations, and every country that joins the United Nations implicitly agrees to support the 30 articles of the Universal Declaration, and those include such things as the right to a fair trial, the right not to be tortured, the right to express one's political, nonviolent political and religious beliefs, the right to a free press and free speech. Other rights, though, in the social and economic arena, the right to health care, the right to housing, that sort of thing. Those are the fundamental human rights that every human being can claim. You know, of course, there had throughout history been many other statements from the time of the Magna Carta to the U.S. Bill of Rights during the French Revolution, the Declaration on the Rights of Man and the Citizen. But all of those had applied only to one particular nation or nationality or group of people. And the genius of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which of course came into being just a few years after the Holocaust, was that it guaranteed rights to everybody, including my enemies. So it was not just like the U.S. Bill of Rights that apply only to Americans. It applied to every single human being simply by virtue of their being human. And there have over the years gradually been a great many covenants, treaties, conventions dealing with issues like genocide or the rights of women or the rights of prisoners and so on, which have grown up over the years. But the fundamental human rights that everyone can claim are the ones that are articulated in the Universal Declaration.
We have two callers, so let's bring them into the conversation. We'll start first with someone in Lafayette in Indiana, line number 4. Hello. Caller there on line 4. Well, maybe they changed their mind. Let's go here to Southern Illinois, line 1.
Hello, how you doing?
Good.
I kind of understand what you're talking about, but what I don't understand is, you know, we're concerned with human rights and stuff like that, but those human rights are invaded by single individuals. I mean, they may group up or somewhat, but I don't understand how. I mean, if these people within these other, like let's say China, for example, the people that's in the armies that inflict that persecution, they are being pushed by some kind of invisible, really non-existing so-called government. But I mean, it's just one or people around a round table that actually have that control. Where is that power that causes that individual to inflict that stuff upon his own race, his own people? It makes no sense to me. I would think that if the people were educated by their parents or somewhat morally instilled, they would have some kind of say into no, that's not right. I'm not going to do that to my own people. And they would eventually be their own free will governmental person. You know, I don't know how to say it, but I'm sure you understand what I'm talking about. At least I hope. I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, well, I think that it raises a very important question, and one that I'm sure is very difficult. Yes, we can talk about the importance of a policy and an attitude toward human rights as far as governments are concerned, but individuals have to carry out the will of the government, and when you get down to it, I guess you do end up with a question of how is it that one individual finds it possible, acceptable to torture another fellow human being, and isn't that ultimately where the responsibility lies with the people who carry out the wishes of their governments?
Well, I think it lies in both places. That is, it lies both with the government and with the individuals. Certainly, governments are preeminently responsible for enforcing human rights because it is, after all, the governments that have agreed to affirm the Universal Declaration, or it is a government that has signed on to the Convention Against Torture, for example, and has agreed that it will not, as a government, as a society, condone torture or participate in torture or allow torture within its own boundaries. Now, it is certainly true, and the gentleman has asked a very profound philosophical, some might say religious question, is indeed, at what point does any individual stand up and say, in the face of great pressure from the government and no doubt the threat of imprisonment or punishment, no, this what you're asking me to do is morally wrong. And I think that is always a profoundly difficult question. The fact is that we know how torturers are made. In large measure, the way that you get a police officer, a military officer, or anyone else to inflict cruelty on another person is to be cruel to him or her in the first place. And that's one reason that the training of torturers involves a lot of physical and emotional abuse against the torturer, him or herself, long before they are asked to inflict torture on a victim. And it is very difficult for any individual in the face of that kind of training and that kind of abuse, particularly if there are no other social supports, no other people or organizations in that society that are saying to the individual, stop this, don't do this, the government is wrong. Well, we're talking in many cases, China is a good example, about a government that prohibits political opposition, prohibits independent non-governmental organizations like Amnesty or any other organization, prohibits independent church or temple organizations from saying to individual Chinese citizens, this is wrong, you should not cooperate. That, I think, makes for an explosive context in which these kinds of violations do take place.
We have someone on a cell phone. We'll go there next, line number one. Hello.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of things I could say, but what I guess I was going to bring up was with respect to how people in fact engage in such actions. I would remind everyone of these infamous or famous Stanley Milgram experiments, in which Milgram demonstrated that very normal, everyday people off the street can, in fact, be coerced, I suppose, although it was very subtle coercion, into doing very, 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 very horrible things. This was the infamous learner-teacher experiment, where the experiment was really on the teachers. And to see whether they would administer this electroshock therapy to improve learning rates or something like that. Under this sort of when they're subject to what they perceive as legitimate authority, a very large amount of people will crack, and they just do. And I don't know what to say about that, but if you are willing to isolate someone in sort of a structure that sort of lets them off the hook, as it were, and says, well, you know, I was following orders. Well, they'll do all sorts of things, even if they would never contemplate doing that themselves. As I said, there's a lot of other things I could say, but I don't want to talk too long.
Sure. Well, I appreciate the comment. Dr. Schultz, you want to react to that?
Well, the gentleman has cited what are probably the most famous experiments in these areas. That's absolutely right. Essentially, what happened is that subjects were told that they were administering electroshock to victims. They were told that the shocks were getting greater and greater. At some point, they were told that the victim was crying out. They were told at one point that the victim had slumped over. And a certain number of people, a very significant percentage, I don't remember the exact number, but a certain very significant percentage of people continued to administer this electric shock, even to the point at which it was obvious that they had were imposing extraordinary pain. Now, of course, in fact, this was not happening, but they certainly thought it was. And I think that the gentleman correctly points out that it is very hard for most people to resist the kind of authority. In this case, it was the authority simply of a professor or a test administrator telling them to do something. But in the case of a government where you have huge pressure and the possibility that you yourself will be severely punished if you don't agree, well, I'm not sure it's all that surprising that the vast majority of people go ahead and inflict the pain.
Hmm. We'll continue. We have another caller here. The next person in line is in Aurora, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Two questions. Would anything be done about China and their slaughtering, killing of 500 people in about 4 months because they want to lower their crime rate? And why doesn't the United Nations get involved in the problem between Palestine and Israel?
Well, first, with regard to the question about China, our caller is certainly correct that the Chinese execute more people than any other country on earth. Indeed, Amnesty has documented that the Chinese execute between 1,000 and 4,000 people every year, often for quite what we would consider, I think, quite modest crimes, such as stealing a bicycle or selling a faulty product, or even in one case, pinching someone's bottom as they rode by on a bicycle. So it is certainly one of the most shocking aspects of Chinese practice. And in addition to that, one of the motivations that the Chinese have for keeping the execution rate so high is that they then sell the internal organs, body parts and body organs of those executed on the open market, and they make a considerable profit from them. So it's a gruesome business, and it's certainly one that Amnesty and many other human rights groups have criticized over the years very severely. As to the motivation of the United Nations with regard to the Middle East, I can't speak for the United Nations. Amnesty is, of course, an entirely independent organization. We ourselves have been critical, very critical of the role of the Israeli military and government over the last few months of the Intifada there, the renewed Intifada. We have also, over the years, criticized the Palestinian Authority for its torture of its own dissidents, as well as for some allowing killing of Israeli citizens. But certainly at the moment, there's no question but what the reaction of the Israeli government includes a good many violations of Palestinian human rights.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. I think probably it's also worth making the point that often people, they talk about the United Nations and what it is or is not doing. It's worth remembering that, after all, the United Nations is no stronger, no better, no more effective than its member nations wish it to be.
Sure.
It's just an organization made up of delegations from various countries, often places where the governments of those countries cannot agree on what they want to do. It's an organization that it admittedly perhaps has had some administrative difficulties, but probably is underfunded, and it doesn't help that from time to time that countries like the United States decide that because the United Nations has done something that the U.S. disagrees with, that the U.S. then says, well, we're not going to pay our dues, and if the organization doesn't have money to do its work, then it won't be doing its work. So Sometimes I think I'm not suggesting the caller was doing this, but sometimes I think it's unfair that people criticize the United Nations as if it was something more than this group of nations, including ours.
That's certainly fair.
We're at a bit past our midpoint here. I'll mention again that our guest is Dr. William Schultz. He is Executive Director of Amnesty International USA and was appointed to that post in March of 1994. He's an ordained Unitarian Universalist minister and came to Amnesty after serving for 15 years with the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations and has certainly been involved in human rights work many places around the world. He's also, by the way, just to take note of this, is a graduate of the University of Chicago, has a master's degree in philosophy from University of Chicago and master's degree in theology and doctor of ministry from the Meadville Lombard Theological School at University of Chicago. And this subject, by the way, is the topic of a book that he's written. And if you're interested in reading more on the subject, the book is titled In Our Own Best Interest, How Defending Human Rights Benefits Us All. It's published by the Beacon Press. And the questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Toll free 800-222-WILL. We'll go next to, back here locally, to Champaign and line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a kind of a question and kind of a statement or something. I belong to International Amnesty Group, 10, 15 years ago, I don't know. And it sounded like a wonderful organization and everything, and I always like to help, you know, people that are in tight spots. Well, they wrote to me and said, would you write to such and such a government on behalf of such and such a person who's in prison there and being mistreated and everything, and they didn't tell me why he was in there or anything. And then right at the last it said he's a communist, and that threw up a red flag. Well, maybe he was doing something that was against that government. Maybe that's the reason he's in prison. What kind of an organization am I in? Anyway, I backed off and got out of it. And I was just wondering, I guess communists need to be helped as much as others, but it was kind of shocking to me for the first request that they made. So what do you have to say about that?
Well, of course, I don't know the details of the case that you're talking about, but this is what I will explain about Amnesty. Amnesty believes in universal human rights. We believe that no human being, regardless of their political or their religious beliefs, if they have not practiced violence, that no human being should be subjected to unfair imprisonment, that everyone who is charged with a crime should be given a fair trial, and that no one, whether they're a communist or anything else, should be tortured. Those are basic human rights that apply to someone who regards him or herself as a communist as much as they apply to someone who is the most ardent capitalist. So I don't, again, know the details of your particular case. It is certainly true that in the cases of those people who call themselves communists, who were not involved in nonviolence, they may well have been declared prisoners of conscience by Amnesty. That is, people who nonviolently advocated a political or religious point of view and were imprisoned for it. It's also true, of course, that Amnesty has always advocated for anti-communists who have been thrown into jail by communist governments. So, for example, some of our major work during the years of the Soviet Union was to attempt to free Soviet dissidents, people who had opposed the Soviet government. Today, for example, we are among the most ardent critics of Fidel Castro and his holding of journalists and religious leaders and others who disagree with his regime and who do so nonviolently. So Amnesty protects everybody, ma'am, communists or not, because we believe, just as the U.S. Constitution assures American citizens, that whether they are communists politically or not, they cannot sacrifice certain rights to a fair trial and the right not to be tortured. So we believe that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights guarantees every human being those same rights as well.
All right, let's go on. Next caller is Belgium, line number three. Hello.
Hello. Early in your discussion, your guest suggested that he was going to show reasons why Amnesty International and its practices were going to be good for economic reasons. Well, it seems to me that all the way through history, and even going on to today, native peoples of the world have always been maligned seriously for the economic advantage of those who are maligning them. We do that not only to people, but we do it to various species in our world, animal and vegetable, of course, flora and fauna. And it seems to me that we're all very, very guilty of this in an economic sense, because capitalism will just extort people easily every day, whether it's in a foreign country or even in our own country, where we try to push the wages down as far as we can and maximize the profits for the shareholders. Do you deal with any kind of that aspect of torture to the human spirit?
Well, let me say that Amnesty does not take a position on economic systems. Again, our job is to try to enforce civil and political rights under whatever system a country may adopt. But I certainly agree with the gentleman that, for example, the exploitation of labor is one of the ways in which Americans do suffer from human rights violations. In 1999, 500,000 Americans who were working in the manufacturing sector lost their jobs because U.S. companies moved to countries that deny workers in those countries the right to organize labor unions, and hence deny them the right to campaign for a living wage and for better working conditions. It costs about $8.31 an hour to make a T-shirt in New York with unionized workers. In Bangladesh, with non-unionized workers, it costs about 1 cent an hour. Where does one suspect textile companies are going to prefer to do business? Of course, they prefer to do business in the developing countries. And that is just one example of part of my argument, which is indeed that by allowing for the violation of indigenous people, in this case Bangladeshis, we not only, of course, harm them and their human rights, but we also harm ourselves if we have any interest in keeping American jobs in the manufacturing sector.
The point I'm making, sir, though, is that we even do it to our own citizenry. We do it to individuals. How long did we castigate the blacks when we made them slaves for, 200-300 years? We still do it to everybody. Any incoming group that comes into the United States and immigrates to the United States.
Well, that's why Amnesty is one of the major defenders of the rights of political asylum seekers. And certainly, as I said earlier on the program, Amnesty is one of the major opponents of police misconduct, which is primarily aimed at people of color. One of the major opponents of injustice in U.S. prisons, which is primarily applicable to people of color.
Sir,
all of these issues.
Sir, I'm not pointing out the fact that the police do it. I'm pointing out the fact that you and I do it by economic reasons.
Sir, I understand your point. All that I'm saying is I have outlined for you what Amnesty's job is, if you're interested, as many people are, in addressing economic rights issues and the impact of globalization on our economy. There are many other organizations that work on those, and we would encourage you to be part of them.
Thank you.
All right, we'll continue. Let's go to Southern Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I don't want to refer to one specific point that you made, and which I agree with you. We participated with the Chilean government in order to promote the military system of Pinochet, which is a shame of that country. And I visited there, exactly the place where Kissinger met with the Chilean people in order to arrange the assassination and the coup. I mean, I was right there. I mean, I was shown exactly by a person that was on the other side. They was on the side of the military because they wanted the Allende to be out. So that it was a very impartial person. And once they also... is very right in suggesting that it is in our best interest to fight for human rights. And but you know, there is one thing. When are we going to do something? It keeps on happening. It happens It happened, what, a couple of years ago with in Europe. It's happening today with Hispanic people coming from Mexico. I mean, it's a new form of slavery. I work with the Hispanics and try to defend their rights. And when they're buying a home, and I'm there to help that they're not abused and cheated, and they are the American companies try to cheat the Hispanics when they're buying their little home. We have the sweatshops. Sweatshops are all over the world in violation of human rights. And by the whole world, I mean, especially by the powers. Well, when are we going to stop that? That's my big question. What are we doing? I know that you are working on it, but besides you having your group, is there any more being done? I have a question.
Well, certainly you raise many important questions. There are, of course, a lot of organizations that do work on the issues that you're addressing. There are organizations devoted to protecting the rights and liberties of Hispanic people and many other groups as well. So I don't know that I have much more to add to what the lady has said, except to confirm that indeed U.S. alliances with countries that are involved with human rights continue, and they continue to work against our own interests. And perhaps one of the best recent examples was the shooting down of the American missionaries in Peru.
Right, exactly.
That was an instance in which the U.S. government, over the last 6 or 8 years, had aligned itself very closely, not only with President Fujimori of Peru, who has subsequently sought exile in Japan because he is under very significant charges of corruption in Peru, but also with his chief intelligence officer, Mr. Montesinos, who we utilized despite charges that he had been responsible for massacres in that country, and who was one of the preeminent sponsors of the military airplane activities that ultimately caused the death of the missionary family in Peru. So I think that we have not learned our lessons in this respect, and we would do well to be far more cautious about those with whom we align ourselves.
Americans were killed. Chile is my previous country, and I do have the love for my country, but Americans were killed in Chile.
Well, absolutely. In fact, Amnesty has worked hard to try to get the government, the U.S. government, to disclose documents under the Freedom of Information Act.
The American government didn't want to have anything to do with it, and they said they didn't have anything to do. They did not want to get involved.
Well, I understand, but there are documents that I think would show that the U.S. was involved not just in the deaths of Chileans, but of the deaths of Americans in Latin America as well.
Exactly. Well, I thank you for your work.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We just have about 10 minutes left. I think in the past, I think that people who were concerned about the United States supporting regimes that did not respect human rights, that, and when we asked the question, why did that happen in the past, I think the number one reason would have been the Cold War.
Sure.
Now, though, it seems that it has, now that the Cold War is gone, it seems that if we look at the reasons why this government might support other regimes that don't respect human rights, it does seem that economic reasons come to the fore, and that it's our desire to maintain those countries as markets. That's the reason why. Do you think that's true?
Yes, you're absolutely right. But let me give you a couple of examples of how short-sighted that is. ExxonMobil just announced a couple weeks ago that it was having to withdraw from its investment, multi-$1 million investment in natural gas fields in the province of Aceh, Indonesia, because of the political violence there. That violence has been caused by years and years of political repression and denial of basic human rights, which the United States turned a blind eye to during all the years of the Suharto regime in Indonesia. Another example, we are currently building a pipeline through Kazakhstan and attempting to bring oil from the Central Asian republics into Turkey. Almost all of those countries are ones that have abysmal human rights records. That means that they are politically unstable. We may invest millions, if not billions of dollars, to build a pipeline that may eventually fall into the hands of others who don't have our best interests at stake. In each of these cases, and in every other case where the U.S. has aligned itself with a human rights disdainful regime, we need to take human rights as seriously in our relationship with a Suharto or with the presidents of the Central Asian republics as we do our economic interests, because the two are intimately tied. And not just for the U.S. government, but for private business as well, because business, in order to do business successfully in a country, requires political stability. It requires a free flow of accurate financial information. Well, you don't get that if you don't have a free business press. It requires the fair enforcement of laws and contracts. Well, you don't get that if you don't have an independent judiciary. And it requires as little corruption as possible. Well, you almost always get corruption in a country that has no independent monitoring groups, no free press, no political opposition parties. So in all these ways, our economic interests, whether it be corporate interests or whether it be government interests or whether it be individual economic interests, because 10% of Americans' pensions are invested overseas, in all these ways, human rights have a very profound impact on our economic and financial interests.
We have about 7 or 8 minutes left. Our guest is Dr. William Schultz. He's Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, and we're talking about some of the thoughts that you will find in his book, In Our Own Best Interest, How Defending Human Rights Benefits Us All. We have a couple of other calls. We'll try to get them both in the time that remains. We'll go next to Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Has Amnesty made any criticism of any of the cruel forms of abortion? We have very clear sonograms of abortion, which show that babies recoil and they writhe in pain while they're being dismembered during abortion. And almost everyone now knows, is aware of the partial birth abortion, in which late-term healthy babies, these are healthy babies, they're viable, and they're almost fully delivered, but when they're just about fully delivered, they're then stabbed into the brain, into the back of the neck, into their brain. No anesthesia. They're stabbed in the back of their brain. A cannula is inserted into the stab hole, and their brain is sucked out. By the way, they react in pain. We have testimony of nurses that have witnessed this procedure. The babies react in pain. They're in pain when this occurs. They're stabbed in the back of the neck. Their brains are sucked out.
I think we take your point. Dr. Schultz, you want to respond?
Amnesty takes no position one way or the other on the issue of abortion, and I'll explain to you why. Amnesty formulates its positions based not upon our own judgments as an organization or as individuals or as leaders within the organization one way or the other on any human rights issue. We formulate our positions based upon a consensus of opinion as it has emerged among international human rights organizations and groups that determine what is or is not an accepted violation of human rights. So, for example, the UN Human Rights Commission, the Inter-American Court for Human Rights, the Inter-European Commission on Human Rights, there are many international human rights bodies that make judgments on cases, and they are the ones who determine the consensus at the international level with regard to all of these issues and decide what does or does not constitute a violation of human rights. To give you an example, 20 years ago, there was no consensus among such organizations and bodies that the death penalty was a violation of human rights, and 20 years ago, Amnesty took no position on the death penalty. Well, the fact is, for better or for worse, obviously, this gentleman will think it's for a great deal worse, but for better or for worse, there is no consensus at the international human rights level with regard to issues of abortion. And therefore, Amnesty, which has among its members people who feel very strongly on all sides of that issue, Amnesty takes no position one way or the other on the issue of abortion.
Well, may I say that that consensus might change if the babies got a vote?
I've answered your question.
I think so. Let's go to Champagne. One more person here, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Good morning. I belong to a group of a very informal group.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did that. We dumped the caller. My mistake. My apologies to the caller. If he wants to call back, we'll get him on the air. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Just to go back to the I don't mean to belabor the point of the last caller, but I guess there are some people that would say there was some kind of inconsistency involved in, on the one hand, not taking a position on abortion, but on the other hand, taking a position on capital punishment.
Well, I understand that. And what I can tell you is solely that this is the position that has emerged with regard to these various international human rights bodies. And for better or for worse, the other has not emerged at this point. If it were to emerge, then obviously, if it fell within Amnesty's mandate, then we would, of course, take a position on it.
All right. Let's get back here to our caller in Champaign. My apologies. That was my mistake in cutting you off.
No problem.
Go ahead.
Okay. My question is, I belong to a group of friends here in Champaign. We get together and write Amnesty letters each week. And despite my commitment to human rights and to my belief in Amnesty as an organization, in general, I can't help sometimes but have the feeling that, or sort of question, what the ultimate fate of each of these letters is that I write. Like, in particular, if I'm writing to someone, let's say the head of the Taliban government in Afghanistan, for example, I can't help but think, well, it just sort of gets tossed onto a pile. And I was just wondering if you might be able to address, sort of the ultimate fate and what actually happens on a practical level to letters that are written in the name of Amnesty International. And
I'd be very happy to, and thank you.
Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you for your work and the work of all the other people who work on behalf of Amnesty. Anyone else who's interested in doing so can check out our website at amnestyusa.org, and there will be a whole variety of ways, from community, local groups, to network, cyberspace, and so on, that one can be involved. And let me just say about the messages, we are able to confirm that we are able to help people in about 40% of the cases. Even where we are not able to free someone or stop them from being tortured, the letters do make a significant difference in a vast majority of cases. And I'll give you an example. Wei Jingsheng, who is called the father of Chinese democracy, who was in prison for 17 years, when he was freed, I said to him, Wei, did you ever get any of the Amnesty letters, tens of thousands sent to you over those 17 years? And he said, no, I never got a single one. But I'll tell you what, Bill, he said, I always knew when the letters were coming because the guards treated me more kindly. They would put out the light in my cell at night. They would give me better food. They would stop the beatings. And when the letters tailed off, the exact opposite happened. And the reason is that even in that very repressive situation where the prisoners may not get the letters, the fact that the government and the military officials or the prison officials know that the world is watching, they do not want to be perceived as pariahs. Even the Taliban is concerned now that it is only recognized by two other countries in the world. Keep those letters going. You may feel, of course, that because you don't get an answer, you can't tell for sure that they're having an impact. In the vast majority of cases, I assure you they are.
All right. There, we'll have to stop just because we're out of time. Dr. Schultz, we want to say thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Our guest, Dr. William Schultz, he's the executive director of Amnesty International USA, and his book, if you'd like to read it, is titled In Our Own Best Interest, Defending Human Rights Benefits Us All. It's published by the Beacon Press.